the Lord Lieutenant, distinguished guests, er en gaitar sjæsses minnum og vikas av åla satt en fyrkin fortsatt, og derif sjæl rom heimis rett med fann kæle særfi. Is den delen anna sætt med flottlig laksa talusje madeljum heim. Thank you, Lord Rana, for your kind introduction. And I want to wish you well in your new role as patron of the John Hewitt Society. In fact, I'd like to pay tribute to everyone associated with the Society, and in particular to Tony Kennedy, its director. It was he who suggested that I should speak here today, and thus far I'm happy that he was so persuasive. I also want to acknowledge the extraordinary, generous welcome that I have received here, and also acknowledge the distinguished guests in the audience, the Deputy Lord Lieutenant, as I've said, the Lord Mayor, Cardinal Sean Brady, Archbishop Richard Clark, the United States Consul General Gregory Burton, and all those in the corridory, the councillors from Armagh District Council, and those from other councils who will be joining Armagh next year. Is a shan kate shata viagam tiagsko art walkam aruktroni herin, agus tam dar noir an olus mater leshen rehunus machnum of a hog eight the blackum ar hapla, irisher eren axe medidio trocket the gurche fui ar maka, your hogshe car gianure, abas the lord, fair in its sight, its sacred buildings and homes of learning, its air of quietude, culture, and ease. So yes, I'm very pleased to have had this first opportunity to come here as President of Ireland, and it is for that reason I was reflecting on A. de Blockham's words. I approached the subject of John Hewitt, his life and work and legacy, and I have to tell you, it's many years now I have tried to have the opportunity of coming to this wonderful school. I think it was the poet Gerald Orr who first asked me to come along, but I am pleased to have the opportunity now. And I approach the subject of John Hewitt, his life, his work and legacy, with a certain amount of trepidation in a region, as he would put it, that is so leavened by the poetic instinct. And this encourages a kind of humility from such as myself. That humility becomes more of a necessity than a suggestion. But as I am about to speak in tribute to one who was so well aware of the appalling waste of life that is war, a writer of conscience, indeed, as Lord Rana has said, who kept returning to the ethics of his internationalism, I am very conscious that the current circumstances of violent loss of life in which I am speaking are ones that would not only break John Hewitt's heart, as they are breaking the heart of so many as I speak, but they would also probably force his pen. Allow me then just a few words on these present circumstances. I believe that the enormous increase in unsettled conflicts at the present time represents a great challenge to the international community. It also represents a great failure. And it must surely be a matter of profound concern to citizens across the globe and their heads of state and leaders that so many conflicts in Gaza, Syria, Iraq, Ukraine and elsewhere have endured to the point where loss of life is now increasing on a daily basis. Security is decreasing and refugee numbers are escalating as displacement drives on relentlessly with horrific consequences on the most vulnerable. It is a time when we are challenged to innovate in the search for peace, realizing that a status quo of unacknowledged failure or the bad management of the consequences of diplomatic failure within a diplomacy of narrow interests is threatening all of our human achievements. One might well ask, where are the fruits of our efforts as an international community? What alternatives to violence have we advanced with authenticity and commitment? The appalling and escalating loss of life in Gaza is a tragic example of an open wound transmitted from generation to generation, of the failure of diplomacy. And there is an awareness among our citizens of the importance of building and securing peaceful resolution to such conflicts, which challenge us all. And in recent weeks, I, as President, have received a great volume of correspondence from members of the public expressing their horror at what is happening. And I share that horror at the perceived failure of language itself, as I know you do, in celebrating the life and work of John Hewitt, one who cared so deeply about peace and the relations between peoples and places. It is only appropriate, then, that we reflect on the relevance and resonance of Hewitt's work in the atmosphere of today's conflicts. And I could not really speak, Lord Drummond, with authenticity of Hewitt without making reference to these current events. In preparation for my speech today, I read inter alia Peter MacDonald's assessment of John Hewitt in the Oxford Handbook of Modern Irish Poetry, in which MacDonald makes the remark that in a way, John Hewitt dead has been far more influential than John Hewitt the living writer. This view is no doubt influenced by the fact that he is now a subject of that most potent form of Irish commemoration, the Literary and Academic Summer School. And I wish to acknowledge my date in presenting these remarks this morning to Frank Ormsby's magnificent introduction to the collected poems of John Hewitt, and to such fine memoir pieces of that of Patricia Craig in a recent edition of what I regard as the incomparable Irish Pages, which I read. What an excellent programme you have for this week, with one of Ireland's leading poets, a dazzling prose writer and memoirist, John Montague, as one of your speakers at this summer school. I will be reflecting briefly on just some of the connections John Hewitt made with John Montague, and how these connections have given us a greater insight into the meaning of Hewitt's work. John Hewitt was, of course, a regionalist, but he also was a migrant. And when I visited Coventry as part of my state visit to the United Kingdom earlier this year, I met many Irish immigrants who were amongst that 500,000 Irish men and women who travelled to England in the 1950s to work on the construction sites and the hospitals and schools and in so many other sectors of economy and society. Circular migrants, seasonal migrants, and settled migrants. And I found it a joy to be able to celebrate the fact that there is now virtually no aspect of British civic or political life that has not been enriched by the Irish community. And they have gained from their reception. And I was pleased to bear witness to their contribution to the culture and life of Britain, and in turn to their continuing contribution as migrants and people of new shores to the renewal of our own Irish identity. Of course, it was Coventry that received a very special migrant from these shores in the 1950s, when John Hewitt left Northern Ireland to take up the position of director of the Herbert Art Gallery and Museum. It was while there, from what must have been a bittersweet exile, that he wrote many of his most thoughtful and resonant poems, including An Irish Man in Coventry, which he composed the year after he moved to that city. That poem which ends with the words, "Yet like Lear's children banished to the waters, our hearts still listen for the landward bells." It is interesting to reflect on how Hewitt's sense of identity seems to have changed on his move to Coventry. He was an Ulster man in Northern Ireland, but an Irish man in England. And to such issues of identity and memory, how Hewitt, of course, gave a very great deal of reflection. And in his article in the Belfast Telegraph in 1958, he wrote, "In the heart of the English Midlands, looking back from the fulcrum of middle age and my personal adventures, among those books which were a significant part of my Irish past, I sometimes wonder if time and distance have given me a perspective and objectivity, or if sentiment and the ordinary wear and tear of memory may not have distorted details and proportion. Hewitt's vision of Ulster was a tapestry that in its making included a multitude of identities competing for space. His Ulsterman was part Celt, Briton, Saxon, Dane and Scot, time and this island tied a crazy knot. But the threads and colours of categories and their naming should not obscure us, as indeed, Lord Hannah, you have reverted from us the gift that Hewitt had, the gift of the rich cloth of a father's egalitarian thought, an egalitarianism that would endure for life as a legacy. One that might, as Frank Ormsby tells us, have led to John Hewitt's youthful borrowing of 10 shillings from his mother to buy a second-hand 5-volume set of William Morris's The Earthly Paradise. Hewitt said of his poem, The Colony, that it was the definitive statement of his realisation that he was an Ulsterman. In this poem, Hewitt conjured the point of view of a Roman coloniser in England in the historic period when the Roman Empire itself was in decline. Edna Longley has declared that poem this a sophisticated poetic model of Ulster politics. The Irish Times used its closing line, "We shall not be outcast on the world," for the title of an editorial responding to an initiative British Prime Minister Edward Heath in 1972. That would result in the Sunningdale Agreement later that year. The editor argued that the majority in Northern Ireland now had a chance to prove that they are in their right place and wrote, in the words of their own poet John Hewitt, the Northern majority will be able to say, we would be strangers in the capital. This is our country also, nowhere else, and we shall not be outcast on the world. Hewitt was very forthright, of course, in invoking and declaring his planter identity and heritage. Indeed, as part of the literary tour he undertook in 1970, he jointly published with John Montagu the poetry collection, The Planter and the Gael, with each poet contributing work from their respective viewpoints, and both being very aware of their representative status. What was one to make or say, remember or construe of the lives that had been poured into this space and time that had been shared. In his introduction to that collection, Michael Longley wrote that each poet explores his experience of Ulster, the background in which he grew up and the tradition which has shaped his work. John Montagu defines the culture of the Gael, John Hewitt that of the planter. The two bodies of work complementing each other and providing illuminating insight into the culture complexities of the province. The integrity of both poets, Hewitt and Montagu, and Longley too, is reflected in their rejection of any easy, reductive or accommodating amnesia as to the complex past or its challenges. A study from the 1970s of the use of landscape in The Planter and the Gael by Professor John Wilson Foster of the University of British Columbia pointed clearly to how the land and landscape are called up through the different backgrounds of Montagu and Hewitt. The poems of Montagu reflect loss, decay, absence and exile, whereas Hewitt views the land through a planter's sensibility, one of invoking the human labour expended on it, the memory of harnessing its fertility, husbanding it and taming it for productive use. This legacy, these legacies, constitute an invocation of Irishness, for Hewitt's identity was bound up in place and landscape. Another such example of Hewitt's connection to the landscape can be seen in his poem Townland of Peace, in which he traces his sense of himself, of his family and of the landscape from his grandfather's time to the present. There is here, I believe, a claim for a sovereignty of sensory intimacy, an intimacy not appropriately mediated by either the ideological abuse of memory or a limiting pursuit of any respectability brought to fruition in property or false proprieties. Perhaps the most resonant example of Hewitt's understanding of the complex identity faced by those in Northern Ireland is contained in his essay, Planters Gothic, an essay in discourse of autobiography. In that work, Hewitt discussed his reaction to a planter's Gothic tower built on the remains of a round tower. Discussing its impact on him, he said, "It is the best symbol I have found for the strange textures of my response to this island of which I am a native. It may appear planter's Gothic, but there is a round tower somewhere inside and needled through every sentence I utter." This is so similar to Derek Walcott's, for example, invocation of Shakespeare's tongue to convey Caribbean realities of slavery and its succeeding responses. As well as this multifaceted understanding of identity that he recognised as existing in Northern Ireland, Hewitt was also very aware of the wider connection of the region which he regarded as home and about which he wrote, Europe. And in an introduction to A Catalogue for an Art exhibition taking place in Belfast, he wrote, "At the beginning of the last century, Belfast was in full contact with the flow of European events. But in the intervening period, mainly for political economic reasons, the scope of wit and culture suffered a time lag of increasing proportions. Our province became provincial. However, since the Great War, and partly consequent upon it, the acceleration of social change has narrowed the gap between Ulster and Europe. Once again, our best aesthetic thought is coloured by contemporary tendencies." Hewitt himself, of course, had spent time in Europe, and the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland, which holds his notebooks, contain detailed accounts of his education and holidays in Europe. As they wryly note, because of his egalitarian sympathies, he was naturally attracted to Russia and countries such as Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, Poland, and Yugoslavia. Any reflection of mine, of course, just now, or any consideration of how the materialist and statist excesses in such locations would change a utopian vision into a dystopia, in terms of the communal options and responses that might have replaced the abuses of empire, and how this affected John Hewitt, I'm afraid has to wait for another day, or perhaps another visit. Hewitt was very insistent that the placement of his home region into the wider context was vital, and that missing out on any element of the broader picture would lead to profound misunderstandings. In his letter to John, one of his letters to John Montagu, he stated, "I always maintained that our loyalties had an order to Ulster, to Ireland, to the British archipelago, to Europe, and that anyone who skipped a step or missed a link falsified the total. The Unionists missed out Ireland, the Northern Nationalists, the Green Tories couldn't see the Ulster under their feet, the Republicans missed out both Ulster and the archipelago, and none gave any heed to Europe at all, now perhaps willy-nilly, bundled in the European rump of the common market, clearer ideas of our regional and national allegiances and responsibilities may emerge, or our whole sad, stubborn conglomeration of nations may founder and disappear forever." Hewitt's views on the opportunity that Europe presented to Northern Ireland was very close to the thinking of the Swiss philosopher Denis de Rougemont. Rougemont, a member, was a committed European who saw that Europe, post the Second World War, needed a new concept of unity. He looked to the regional model, to the principle of subsidiarity, and also to the origins of the continent and its founding myths. For him, Homer's stories of the Iliad and the Odyssey were more relevant than the nation-state for understanding the future of Europe. Indeed, for Rougemont, the ultimate foundation of our European identity is not the national state at all, but the European unity represented by our shared cultural roots. The ancient myths that we, along with the other peoples of Europe, have as the foundations of our literatures, provide us with the opportunity for a shared vision and also a respect for cultural diversity. Invocation of myths and their influence on the progress of Europe, however, is not to make a hegemonic claim, or much worse, create an undertone assertion as to origins. Our founding myths are universal, and their traces are in the diverse locations of the wisdoms of the world in all our different faith systems. I think that Rudemann was very perceptive in his insights that a shared influence of myths and cultural memory intangibly links us all together in Europe. Yet that is neither the exclusive nor the sufficient reflection of the intellectual roots of our sensibility. The categories of both memory and imagination, after all, must always remain open. And a further example of such sensibility, drawn from a universal myth, is seen in a poet who was a contemporary of Hewitt in the Belfast group, Michael Longley. On the eve of the IRA ceasefire in 1994, Longley had been working on a poem based on the Iliad. He sent a copy of the finished work to John Banville, then literary editor of the Irish Times. Recognising the quality and meaning of the work, Banville stopped the presses and ensured its inclusion in the paper in the same week as the ceasefire was declared. The poem is based on that episode in the Iliad which tells the story of Priam, the king of Troy, and Achilles, the Greek warrior, who killed his son Hector. I have so often quoted the words of Michael Longley since I became president. And Longley gives Priam these words: "I get down on my knees and do what must be done, and kiss Achilles' hand, the killer of my son." One cannot but be struck by the generosity, empathy, and remorse that are reflected in these words by Longley, rooted as they are in a poem that has its origins 3,000 years ago. Longley's words echo back through the millennia to Homer and forward to today with immediacy and power. And while Troy was not saved by that gesture, the moral intention and the action and the words has its own sustaining power beyond succeeding circumstances. May be appropriate then for us to remember Hannah Arendt's suggestion that to have authentic meaning, forgiveness must be aimed at either preventing or enabling future events, events over which we all must have influence. Denis de Rougemont coined the phrase "a Europe of the regions." He suggested that it was necessary to leave behind arid concepts of territorial divisions and instead consider the interdependent relationships that all communities experience. For him, the key thing was to allow human communities to cooperate in very practical ways, and he was particularly interested in transboundary regions which he felt would be in the vanguard and the teaching the rest of Europe how to order itself. He considered that it was only by overcoming divisions that we would preserve our diversity. For Hewitt, concepts of the region and regionalism were themes that he engaged with through both his prose work and his poetry. His vision of regionalism began with a revival of the poetry of peace and feeling and its language. He worked throughout his life to promote the regional culture of Europe, of Ulster, as a distinct identity. In his poem, Townland of Peace, he wrote, "But these small rites require a smaller stage than the vast forum of the nation's rage, for they imply a well-compacted space where every voice recalls its nation's place, town land, town quarter, county at its most." Hewitt was of the view, as he put it, Ulster considered as a region and not as a symbol of any particular creed can command the loyalty of every one of its inhabitants. For regional identity does not preclude, rather it requires membership of a larger association. And whatever that association may be, There should emerge a culture and an attitude, individual and distinctive, and no mere echo of the thought and imagination of another people or another land. This is both a suggestion and a recognition of the importance of a rooted imagination, a multi-rooted, uninhibited, generous, unrepressed imagination. Moving towards the end then, culture, I suggest, can never be regarded as a residual. Hewitt never saw it as that. Culture is a foundation stone, one that can play an enormous role in reinvigorating the wider society. Lord Ranelagh, you have referred to my time when I was Minister for Culture. Indeed, when I was in Ireland during Ireland's presidency of the European Union, in 1996 I had the opportunity to oversee a key piece of legislation that focused on the integration of cultural aspects into community actions. It affirmed that access to culture and the expression of cultural identity were essential conditions for the full participation of citizens in society. And in this current period of high unemployment, its related poverties and insecurities, and as we pursue sustainable economic recovery, we must not lose sight of the key path that culture offers in helping us reclaim a flourishing and ethical, fulfilling role in the wider global community. Hewitt's views on regionalism also bring to mind the ideas of the French theorist and philosopher Paul Ricoeur. In his work, Ricoeur posed the question as to how we might be modern and yet continue tradition, and how we might revive an old dormant civilization as part of a universal civilization. He understood that it was not easy to remain radically and authentically personal and at the same time practice tolerance towards other civilizations. As he saw it, the discovery of the plurality of culture is never a harmless experience. So how is an encounter with different cultures possible when understanding the other can seem such a dangerous venture as could result in the loss of your own cultural heritage? Ricoeur's answer to this question was that a culture had to engage with what had preceded it, what is occurring around it, and what flows from it. In this consideration of regionalism and of what else to mean, the late Seamus Heaney, too, had a perceptive insight when he said, "Each person in Ulster lives first in the Ulster of the actual present and then in one or other Ulster of the mind." Hewitt saw the different traditions as interrelated, and he felt the best way to recognise the reconciling implications of this was at the regional level. For Hewitt, the region was small enough to garner the kind of loyalty which is needed to transcend differences. The region could also act as a counterweight to what he saw as the prevailing force of over-centralisation or over-bureaucratisation. He based this view on his conviction that we must, as social beings, facing the enormously complicated structure that is the modern nation-state, find some smaller unit to which to give our loyalty. He saw this as a necessary precondition, which could then lead on to economic invigoration of regional agriculture and industry and of everything else. John Hewitt's views on the importance of developing a regional outlook can also be seen as his reaction to the impact of partition on Northern Ireland. His hopes of the development of regional loyalty were, of course, stymied by the trouble. But now that we have emerged from that dark period, there is an opportunity to revisit and draw inspiration from Hewitt's ideas of regionalism. I am struck particularly by the recent analysis of the 2011 census results by the Northern Ireland Statistics and Research Agency. For the first time, the census has started to ask questions about national identity. Particularly striking was that when asked for the first time how they viewed their own national identity, 29% of the people included Northern Irish as a part of that identity. So something new was emerging there. Hewitt's reflections and understanding of these complex questions, regionalism and identity, are relevant in grasping the situation that currently exists in Northern Ireland and how people see themselves in the context of their wider allegiances to Ireland and the United Kingdom. People are perhaps now more comfortable and see it as more meaningful to be endorsing multiple identities that suit the shifting way in which we as individuals and communities relate to a world that is increasingly fluid and porous, one that we must struggle beyond boundaries to achieve, and states as well, in order to make accountable and sustainable lives together. And we must take into consideration, too, that new community of immigrants to Northern Ireland, with more than 120,000 arriving between 2000 and 2010. To quote an assembly paper, there is little doubt that the inflow of new residents from countries as far apart as Poland, Brazil and East Timor has enriched the culture and society of Northern Ireland. And so it will be fascinating to hear from those migrants how they view their own identity changing as they respond to what they are making their own home region. And also to see what their responses will be to the national identity questions at the next census in 2021 and beyond. May I conclude, my focus still complete leisure made around the wrong is Gramilamaki Asulfaja. May I just say, Hewitt was a man who understood that we are all the carriers of multiple allegiances, multiple identities, empowered by hopes and ideas, and versions of worlds yet to be realized or created. John Hewitt understood that to find peace, he needed to know his own place in the world. His lifelong work was to understand himself and his place, his identity, his culture, his region. To achieve an understanding of the self and the world in not just its successes, but its vulnerabilities. And he informed it all with an inherited respect for the power and potential of an emancipatory egalitarianism. These existential reflections, rooted to a moral utopian instinct, that remain as valid and as valuable today as they did when few at first considered them. So it is with great gratitude and respect that I grant him the final word from his powerful poem of personal memory and the intimacy of peace, Townland of Peace. Now and forever, through the change-rocked years, I know my corner in the universe, my corner, this small region limited in space by sea, in the time by my own dead. Garamaki. Thank you.